You're with us for the morning show as we discuss Native American tourism. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Tourism is an economic driver for Native communities. And according to Native America Travel, this is a site promoting tourism, about one-third of federally recognized Native American tribes have gaming operations. But there is so much more to tourism beyond casinos. Are you a business owner on a reservation? How has the pandemic hit home? What is the status of tourist activity for your tribal nation? What are the budgetary consequences? 800-642-1234. Suzette Brewer is Executive Director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin. Suzette, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Greetings, and thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Well, there are 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. Walk us through a challenge that perhaps all tribal nations are experiencing, are grappling with due to COVID.
Well, there's just no easy way to put it. 2020 was pretty devastating for the tribes across the country, but, you know, Wisconsin was hit particularly hard because, you know, it's in the north. The tribes north of 29 are, you know, a little more remote than the ones in the south of the state. And so we are confronting probably an 80% shortfall in our revenues from 2019. That is unprecedented. It has never happened before, and it's probably going to take, you know, a good while for the tribes to recover even to the 2019 levels of funding.
Is this mostly hitting the gaming piece, the gaming industry?
No, I would say it's hit every sector of their economies. Now, tribal economies, as you probably are aware, they're not huge. Tourism is probably the number one industry in Indian country. You know, in addition to the casinos, there's also hotels, there's golf courses, there's, you know, gas stations, all those sorts of things. But with the pandemic, many of these businesses have been hit really hard because people just aren't traveling like they normally would. And they're not staying in the hotel. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I want to look at one particular case with the Bad River LaPointe Band of the Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians. The Bad River Band, one of six Ojibwe bands in Wisconsin. And Bad River Lodge, which has been shut down, what is the impact on the tribe?
Well, the first and biggest impact is that those revenues are really not for show. That funding really goes toward human services. It goes toward healthcare, housing, education. It goes toward preschool. It funds elder lunches. It funds a lot of programs and a lot of services that the tribes rely on for, you know, health and human services. And so when you talk about someone like Bad River has probably been the hardest hit of all the tribes. And I think what that means is that people go without jobs and people go without, you know, the funding that they would normally have for the services for, as I mentioned, like preschool and that sort of thing. And, you know, the tribes have been, they have applied and they've received, you know, some of the CARES funding to help, you know, mitigate some of the damage, but that certainly doesn't cover everything.
When you look at where you turn to when you lose so many jobs, especially in Milwaukee as well, the Milwaukee area, what do the tribes do?
Well, at this point, there's not a whole lot they can do other than recover. That is probably mission number one for us this year, is to find a way to get back on the road to economic recovery. As you mentioned, there's 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. I know Oneida has also been hit pretty hard. They laid off almost, I believe, something like 2,000 people. Mm. You know, their operations are a little bit larger, obviously, than Bad River. They have a lot more assets. They have more businesses on the reservation because they're located, as you know, near Green Bay. And so it really has hit them hard as well, and the Ho-Chunk. I think, you know, we're looking at probably a decade-long recovery process. I mean, I hope it doesn't last that long, but I know that it's going to take a while for the tribes to really get back on their feet. But I am hopeful because, you know, we are seeing more vaccinations now. And I think, you know, Wisconsin, you know, they're starting to see a leveling off, I think, of the virus in some places. And so I think the faster, obviously, we can get, you know, through on the other side, hopefully, of the pandemic, we will start to see, you know, more recovery efforts for the tribes. But it's going to take a while.
We're talking with Suzette Brewer, who heads up Native American Tourism of Wisconsin, and we're looking at the crisis and what the tourism piece is showing. You can join in. Are you a business owner on a tribal reservation? What do COVID cases look like in your region? What have customer numbers been lately? How open can you be? Join in at 800-642-1234. Suzette, since the 80s, Wisconsin tribes have used casino gambling, as you mentioned, as a main source of revenue. Which tribal nations own casinos and where? I mean, I was trying to count, and it looks like upwards of 20 or so.
Yeah, I mean, there are 11 federally recognized tribes. Some of them, as you know, have more than one casino.
Multiple,
Yeah, Forest County is one. I think Ho-Chunk's another. And so I think, you know, that is the main source of revenue. I mean, that has become sort of the standard in Indian country across the country for a lot of tribes because, you know, gaming, you know, where gaming is allowed because not all states have gaming. And if the state does not have gaming, typically the tribes can't have it if it's not written within the state's constitution. So that's an important thing to know about Indian gaming. But across the country, you know, we're kind of confronting the same phenomenon because, you know, a lot of the communities are very small, very rural. In the cities where tribes have operations, you know, they're obviously, it's a location-based business. They're obviously going to do more business. But in the north part of the state, as I mentioned before, you know, it's a little more remote and it's a little more rural. And so therefore, you know, you're not going to see the same kind of traffic, even in a normal year. But when the pandemic hit, that literally shut down everything for everybody. But for the tribes in the more remote regions, you know, it has had a particularly devastating impact.
We're talking with Suzette Brewer, who heads Native American Tourism of Wisconsin. Do you work at a tribal casino? How has your work been affected by the COVID crisis? What safety measures are in place? Do you feel safe? Are you open? And to what extent? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Suzette Brewer here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Native American tourism amid COVID and the path forward. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Before the pandemic, tourism to reservations and Native-run destinations had been on the rise, but gaming, a major piece, took a huge hit. The Wisconsin Policy Forum is out with a report that found tribal gaming payments to the state are down around 80%, a roughly $24 million decline. Are you part of a tribal nation in Wisconsin? Is tourism your livelihood? What can you say about preserving tourism in the 11 indigenous nations? Join in 800-642-1234. Suzette Brewer is Executive Director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin, and she's with us for about 10 more minutes. Suzette, can you explain how do these tribal gaming payments work going back to the state general fund, going back to the state coffers?
Well, that is something that is usually baked into the compact agreements with between the tribes and the states. And so that funding comes off the top of their revenues each year. And so the tribes have to submit payments to the state as a form of revenue sharing. That's what it's referred to as. And so, as I mentioned earlier, when that funding doesn't come in, it's impossible for the tribes to be able to you know, make those payments. And
the revenue share becomes drastically reduced.
Yes, that is correct. It becomes very drastic. So it affects the state as well. And one of the things that I'm, you know, always clear about is the fact that, you know, successful Indian tourism is also a win-win for the state because, you know, it's a partnership. It is a compacting agreement. It is something that benefits both parties. I know that goes into the state's general fund, but I know for the tribes, you know, that funding is used for a wide variety of health and human services for the tribes. So it really does have an impact on both ends. And so the economic mission that we're on this year for all of our marketing efforts, for all the work that we're doing with the tribes is to, you know, it's economic recovery.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tourism, of course, but really we're in a serious economic recovery mission for the tribes to help, you know, push as hard as we possibly can to promote, you know, the things that they have to do on the reservations, you know, the other pieces of their economy that we can, you know, point to in order to sort of have an all hands on deck approach to their recovery. Because it may be a while for all of the casinos to be open at full capacity as they were before the pandemic. Some are open right now at half capacity, just depending on what their numbers are. You know, they're opening up, but it's not to the same full capacity that they were before the pandemic.
Well,
so at this point, I think, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Let's look at some tourism opportunities on Native reservations. The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa has the Frog Bay Tribal National Park in Bayfield County, which is the first tribal national park in the U.S. What does this park offer?
That is correct. And Frog Bay, I have to say, is one of my favorite parts of Wisconsin. It's exquisite. It's just such a beautiful park. They have, well, in the summers, obviously, it's, you know, a lot of water sports and hiking and camping and that sort of thing, although there is no camping right now on Frog Bay. But I know they're getting ready to do ice cave tours up near the Apostle Islands on the Red Cliff side. Coming up pretty soon, they have snowshoeing, snow hiking. They have cross-country skiing. All of those, you know, summer and winter sports are available on, frankly, all of the reservations. But Red Cliff is particularly situated, you know, right there on the shores that, you know, they have, you know, a lot of sort of activities to offer for tourists all year round, really.
Yeah, outdoor recreation could be certainly a high point there. What have they learned through creating this national park?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Yeah, what has the Red Cliff Band learned from having this national park? Because they established it nearly a decade ago.
You know, it is, I think, one of the hidden gems in the United States. I wouldn't speak for the Red Cliff, but I know that they have a deep, long connection to the entire region, really. I mean, the tribes, including Red Cliff, have a long, long history in the region, upwards of 20,000 years in some cases. I mean, it's they've been in Wisconsin for time immemorial. They've been around forever, and they have a very intimate knowledge and grasp of their lands. They have collectively over 500,000 acres of land in Wisconsin. And so I think that, you know, the Red Cliff obviously, you know, are in the best position really to talk about the Apostle Islands and Frog Bay and its long history in Wisconsin.
We have our guide to tourism and recreation on tribal reservations. Suzette Brewer is with us. She is executive director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin. You can join in. What are some of your favorite tourism spots on tribal lands? Have you visited them recently? What impression did they make? What can you recommend? Join in at 800-642-1234. Suzette, what are some other destinations where we could venture on perhaps tribal lands, some outdoor winter recreation that you would recommend?
Oh, Lac du Flambeau near Minocqua is just an extraordinary outdoor destination for any tourist any time of year. They have 180 lakes on Lac du Flambeau. They have snowmobiling, they have ATVing, they have all different kinds of winter activities. And really, you can, there's a lot of birding there. You can see eagles pretty much any time of year at Lac du Flambeau. Stockbridge Muncie is another one. It's just a really, they've got all different kinds of, you know, right now here I'm just speaking because it's winter, but all the reservations have some kind of outdoor activity where you can get out and get in nature and really just enjoy yourself in the woods. Then there's also at Oneida, I know that they have limited capacity for their village. And I know that over at Ho-Chunk that they've got different things that they're doing right now too in the outdoor activity area. But all the reservations really have some kind of outdoor activity going right now that people can enjoy and get outside with their families. And that's really important too.
Suzette, may I ask, what is the etiquette like for enjoying recreation on tribal lands if you're not a member of the tribe?
Well, that's a good question, actually, and I'm glad you asked. You know, it's always important, I think, before you go to check in and see, you know, what's available, what is open, because some things, because we're in kind of crazy times right now, just depending on what's going on the reservation, it's always important to check in first. And I think, you know, the first and foremost thing for people to understand is just respect. You know, just respect the surroundings, respect the tribes. You know, make sure that, you know, whatever you take with you, you take back out with you, you know, in terms of refuse and that kind of stuff. I think it's really important just to, you know, just be aware of your surroundings and just be thoughtful and, you know, just pay attention to the signage and that kind of stuff. I think it's really important that people, you know, visit the reservations, but just be aware of whatever restrictions are in place and just be thoughtful about, you know, any signage they have where it says not to go with your snowmobile on that kind of thing.
Yeah, have respect for where you are.
Yeah.
Let's look here at agricultural tourism. You've said it's really important for tribes to have their own food systems. Can you tell us more about food sovereignty and what it looks like to you?
Yes. Food sovereignty among the nation's Indian tribes is probably one of the most important movements that has arisen over the past decade. And it has for a variety of reasons, but I think in general, it's important for the tribes to have their own, you know, food systems in place just for food security, you know, and for their own health and that sort of thing. And all the tribes in Wisconsin are engaged in some kind of food sovereignty projects at this point. Forest County Potawatomi, for example, has 160 acres where they, you know, have their bison herds, they have cow herds, they have chicken coops, they have 17 beehives, they have maple syrup, beehives, high towers for, you know, growing their food year round. And they've also got crops of the Three Sisters, which is corn, beans, and squash. Mm. That is a very typical crop for any of the tribes probably in Wisconsin. And you know, all of them are engaged in some kind of tribal garden. I know Bad River has a tribal garden that they use for their elders. And so as we move into 2021, I know that, you know, we're looking seriously at promoting agriculture as a form of tourism, agricultural tourism, actually. And this is just one of the building blocks that we've identified as a potential for, you know, rebuilding their economies in 2021. So in this coming summer, you know, look for more of our promotional efforts to help the tribes, you know, push their agricultural products throughout the state of Wisconsin and in the region.
Yeah, and certainly rebuilding this summer with tourism as things start to reopen. How do you see that going?
In fits and starts, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think it's important to be realistic about, you know, what's happening, because, you know, you have to understand for a small tribe, especially for a place like Bad River, or Red Cliff or St. Croix, Le Coudre, all those tribes are very small.
Yeah.
So when they have even, let's say, one death, that's, you know, if it's an elder, that's one elder that no longer speaks the language, no longer carries that knowledge and wisdom with them. So five deaths, let's say, for a tribe of that size is a devastation. So
Suzette,
it's going to take a while.
Suzette, thank you for joining us.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Suzette Brewer, Executive Director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin. Ahead this hour, we have Wisconsin's Chief Elections Administrator. Stay with us. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up here on our programming. The Senate impeachment trial of former President Trump resumes this morning, with House impeachment managers and Trump's lawyers beginning to argue their respective cases. You can find live NPR coverage starting at 11 on the NPR News and Music Network of Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary, and as part of the celebration, here's former host Erica Janik reflecting on one of her favorite stories that centered on friendship and adult literacy.
Hello, Wisconsin! There are so many stories that I could have picked, so many that have stuck with me and introduced me to people from all over the state. It was a true blessing to host and produce this show. Now, we did many different series, but one of them that I was most proud of was a series on literacy in Wisconsin. I visited with people all over the state who were kind enough and honestly brave enough to share their stories with me, because being an adult who struggles with literacy isn't something that many people feel comfortable talking about or sharing. And one of the people I met was a woman named Ruth, who was working with her tutor, Bonnie. They met once a week at the Oshkosh Public Library, which is where I met them.
I was recently retired and decided I needed to do something constructive with my time. And I saw in the paper where they were needing volunteers. So I contacted them. I went through the training that you need to go through. I remember I still have the email that Danielle sent me and said, I have a learner for you that I think you would like to work with. And her name is Ruth.
First, when I got here, I had problems of reading, understanding the questions. That person said, well, I know some people up here that could help you with it. So I came up here.
Ruth is my first person that I tutored with, and I think Ruth was working towards her GED initially. That's what brought her to those services. And we've been together since that time.
We read every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday for about an hour.
Sometimes she will help me go over words and solving it out. Because I do have some big words right now that I got a book I'm reading.
But she does really well. We're working on breaking them apart, sounding them out. Ruth is not a child, so I'm not going to teach Ruth like a child. Ruth is very committed to this. She never misses, and she has made such huge progress this last year. It's amazing. The Ruth that I first met was not this Ruth. You were very quiet, and you did not make eye contact. You didn't smile, and now it's like she's just gotten that self-confidence, and she shines when she's here.
I never had people do this before. I usually try to depend on myself. And I love working with her. She's a very sweet lady. But she's been doing a lot of things for me that I don't expect her to do. I mean, she's like my sister, but she's not. She's goes out for me, and I love her for that. I mean, she's a great lady.
Don't make me cry, Ruth. Don't make me cry this morning.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It's the truth. I mean, I'd go out and jump for celebration if I passed the test. You did it. Now, go out there and buy scream the whole world. I did it. That would make me feel so happy and proud. That's my goal right now.
We'll work on that then.
Wisconsin Life means the world to me, and it's a pleasure to share this story with you. My greatest hope for the show was that you would hear people who sound like you and people you didn't know lived in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Erica Janik.
And now we have Wisconsin's chief election official on the line ahead of the spring primary set for Tuesday and the general election set for April 6th. Do you plan to vote in the statewide primary for state superintendent? What questions do you have about voter registration or voting with absentee ballots? Join in 800-642-1234. Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we look ahead, let's look back. What have you learned about Wisconsin's election system from reviewing the November presidential election?
Well, thanks for that question. You know, I think after every election, it is just as important to focus on transparency as it is before an election. That looks a little different, though. After an election, you're looking at the data, you're looking at the numbers, you're doing things like the audits of the voting equipment after an election to understand the record of the election and to really create a roadmap for the future using a data-driven approach. And so we've done a lot to take a look at the data, to put the data out in reports on our website, to share them with the media, so that voters can really see and be involved in that process. You know, so much great work goes into the post-election process to certify the results at the municipal, county, and state level. And then all of our municipal clerks in each of our 1,850 cities, towns, and villages, they're inputting the data from their election into a statewide system. And then we have access to this really robust data set that we're able to dig into. And again, make sure that we understand the November election, present that data to the public. And it also helps us to provide data to inform decisions in the future.
Yeah, let's dig into the data sets the audits. What were some of your top line takeaways from November?
Some of the most interesting data is that we've really seen a shift in the way that voters interact with the election process. Hmm. And I don't think that's any surprise given the pandemic. But in April, you know, we saw this huge shift in terms of voters utilizing in-person and by mail absentee voting. We went from a state that did about 6% absentee by mail to a state that did over 60%. Now, we saw those numbers go down a little bit in April, but we still saw that we went to a state that did about 43% absentee by mail to a historic, again, average of around 6%. We saw in the November election about 40% of people going to the polls on election day, and then about 18% of people that are going to do in-person absentee. So really some major changes in just the way that voters interact with the voting process. which means that we have to make changes to our technology, that your local election officials have to make some pretty major changes in terms of where they allocate their resources. And again, we don't know what that trend is going to look like into the future, but we can take away some lessons learned from that information to continue to make sure that all of our systems are prepared for adjustments in that voter behavior over time.
Yeah, so you saw the sea change in absentee voting. How many complaints did you receive over how the November election was run?
You know, there are different kinds of complaints and avenues for people to voice their opinions. In terms of sworn complaints, where people are providing actual data and asking for us to look into that, there were relatively few. Those are taken incredibly seriously. They're looked at by our 6-member commission, who ultimately makes a decision. But then we have more informal channels that people can relay their thoughts, concerns about election procedures. And this year, in terms of contacts to our office, it was almost threefold from what we've seen in previous elections. So in previous Novembers, during a general or a presidential election year, we'd see something like 10,000 contacts to our office. We're a pretty small office. We have about 31 full-time staff in our office that have election expertise. In the 2020 presidential election, our office saw close to 30,000 contacts to our office. And again, sort of the resourcing level has stayed the same, but the number of contacts coming to our office has increased. And, you know, we pride ourselves on every time somebody calls or emails us, we acknowledge their question, we treat them with respect, and we provide them with a factual, nonpartisan answer as we're required to. And so continuing to maintain that level of customer service with the increase of contacts has certainly been a challenge. And something, again, we'll use that data to drive innovation and improvement to our customer service process.
What did you learn from the recounts that were requested by former President Trump?
So, yeah, I think working with Dane and Milwaukee counties, they were really the ones that run that show, right? The counties are the ones that are charged with running a recount. But I think they learned a lot about how observers can be involved in that process, how you can use technology to show that process. You know, there's engagement with elections. There's transparency in elections in every step. But how do you make that engagement meaningful, right? How do you make sure that people can see the things they expect to see, be involved in the process in a way where they understand the context? And I think that's something that we're all continuing to learn together is in pandemic circumstances, how do you create opportunities for meaningful engagements at recounts, at polling places, so observers, which is a really important role, have an opportunity to really meaningfully be involved.
We are getting an elections update with the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan Wolf is here. Do you trust that elections will be secure now and in the future? What do you want to know about how absentee ballots are handled, where your ballot goes, the process? Be part of this. Your questions answered, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Megan Wolf right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In recent weeks, we invited all 7 candidates vying to be Wisconsin's next state superintendent of public instruction to join us on the air. And nearly all agreed to come on, sharing where they stand on issues facing public schools. That race narrows to 2 on Tuesday. We have Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf on the line to find out how clerks are preparing for the primary and the general election on April 6th. And you can join in. What questions do you have about elections and for our state's chief election official? 800-642-1234. Megan Wolf with us for about 10 more minutes. So can you explain the races that are on the ballots for the next Tuesday, February 16th, statewide election?
So the races on the February ballot include the statewide contest of superintendent for public instruction. There are also 2 special primaries for Senate District 13 and Assembly District 89 to fill vacancies. And then there's going to be 101 separate primaries for things like county board, school district, city, village, and town officials across the state. So the February primary is the February nonpartisan primary. Again, where mostly you're going to see those local contests, those very important local contests on your ballot. And you can check myvote.wi.gov to see what's going to be on your ballot in your community. And while you're there, you can double check your polling place. You can check your registration to make sure it's up to date. And you can also track your absentee ballot if you've already received, requested, or returned your absentee ballot.
I want to ask there about myvote.wi.gov and how the site poses this question on absentee voting. And the question is, can't make it to the polls due to age, hospitalization, or disability. Request an absentee ballot for all elections. What about COVID and the risk of exposure? That was a reason to request absentee ballots in the past.
So the law says that if a voter cannot appear at the polls because of age, illness, infirmity, or disability, that they can certify that on their absentee ballot request. Mm. And that's been the longstanding guidance and law in the state of Wisconsin. It's also been reaffirmed by multiple courts, including the Supreme Court. And the commission has further solidified that guidance by reminding voters that you're the one that has to make that certification. The law says age, illness, infirmity, or disability. When a voter requests their ballot, they have to certify if one of those conditions applies to them. And that you also can't just use it as a means to avoid the photo ID law. We did take a look at our data and found that 80% of voters who have utilized the indefinitely confined status have at some point in the last 4 years shown a photo ID. But that is one of the aspects of that provision as well. And again, it's for each voter to make that determination and to certify to their qualification.
Is it too late to request an absentee ballot for Tuesday?
Yeah, if you're looking at getting your ballot by mail, the post office does say it can take up to 7 days for you to get and return your ballot. We are at day 7 right here. Mm-hmm. So if you have an absentee ballot, get those back right away. You may be able to get it in the mail and get it back, but it has to be back by 8 p.m. on election day. There's no exceptions. And so if you're afraid it won't get back in time, drop it off with your clerk. Go to your municipal clerk's office, drop it off with your clerk. You can go to MyVote to check and see contact information for your clerk and figure out the best way to get that ballot back. If you haven't voted yet, consider maybe in-person absentee. So again, if you go to MyVote, you can contact your local election official and find out about in-person absentee options this week in your community. And then, of course, if you want to vote at the polls on election day, polls are open from 7 a.m. till 8 p.m. next Tuesday, February 16th, and they're safe, they're secure. We've worked a lot with our clerks over the last year to make sure that each polling place is safe, that we've incorporated public health guidance into every step of the process. You're also going to see a very low turnout election, and so there's a very, very low likelihood of things like lines in a February primary.
Yeah, how prepared, Megan Wolf, are clerks for Tuesday's primary compared to the presidential election in November?
So I think that our clerks have been extraordinarily prepared for not just this election, but for November. And here's why. You know, in the state of Wisconsin in 2020, our clerks conducted 4 statewide elections. There was also a special election that was held in May for one of our congressional districts. So a lot of our clerks ran 5 elections under pandemic circumstances in 2020. That's very different than in other states where maybe they had 1 or 2 elections in 2020. And so I think our clerks are very, very prepared in terms of adjustment to absentee requests and the volume that they're experiencing, but also in running government functions. I mean, clerks don't just do elections. They do all sorts of things in their communities. And so I think they've really had to adjust all their procedures to make sure that they can stay safe, that their customers, their voters can stay safe as well. So I think they're extraordinarily prepared. They're just an incredibly dedicated group of public servants, our local election officials are. And I think we should all have a great deal of gratitude for the preparations they've all made to make sure that voting can continue in each and every community in Wisconsin and that it's safe.
I would imagine, too, that they will have enough poll workers considering a low turnout election expected that you won't need to call on the National Guard.
That's correct. You know, February, again, is very low turnout. But I also think that just like voters, that our poll workers are also feeling more comfortable navigating public spaces and serving in that capacity now that they've had the experience through 2020.
Are voters
so we're not hearing of shortages around the state for poll workers?
I'm sorry. Are voters required to wear masks at the indoor polling locations?
So you can't ascribe an additional qualification to voting, right? So it's not a requirement that voters have to wear a mask, but it's certainly encouraged. And so all through 2020, the commission put out guidance that it's encouraged, but it's not a requirement of a voter because you can't ascribe an additional qualification to voting.
We're discussing elections with Megan Wolf, the administrator of Wisconsin State Elections Agency. What questions do you have about voting? Do you trust the process? What would you change on how elections are run? 800-642-1234. Megan, before last year's elections, the Elections Commission awarded grants to help counties improve on their security. Are there still ways that clerks need to improve security? How far have they come?
That's a great question, because I think there's always this misunderstanding that there's some sort of finish line when it comes to security, and there isn't. I think that our clerks did an incredible job in utilizing those grants to make sure everybody had the technology, the security training and support they needed for the 2020 election. But those threats, those concerns, security, it's not going away. And so I think now as a state, we need to figure out how do we sustain those important efforts into the future in each of our 1,850 communities. So I think we're in a great spot right now, but I think we can't rest on that project, because we have to make sure that we're prepared as we head into the future and that we have really sustainable programs in place.
Why are we in a great spot right now?
Right. So, you know, giving those grants to our local election officials, it ensured that even our smallest communities in Wisconsin had the technology, the IT support, and the training that they needed to meet an equal level of security. So whenever they go to do their work in the statewide database, entering voter registration records, recording participation, they all have a secure device with very sophisticated technology on it so that we can ensure their device does not have any sort of threat on it before they access our system. They've all been to training, and they all have IT support that they can call if they have some kind of issue. And so I think that is where we stand right now, and it's pretty incredible to see the progress they've made from even a few years ago, where that wasn't the case in some of our smaller communities.
We only have a few seconds left. Have you heard of experiences of clerk burnout, of exhaustion from what just transpired in 2020 for them?
It has been a long year for election officials. But I think, again, you're looking at a group of just incredibly dedicated public officials. Yes, we do hear of burnout among our local election officials. And I think, you know, in many of our communities, in our 1,200 townships in the state of Wisconsin, this is a part-time job. And so let's support them, sustain their efforts into the future.
Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. You can find more information about registering, voting, and the races on your ballot at myvote.wi.gov. Just ahead, a Pulitzer Prize-winning climate journalist discusses her new book, Under a White Sky. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.